What does it mean to be a playful agent? Because Misha have a reformulation of Nataraja. So yes, first of all, I would like to thank the Oxford Center for Hindu Studies and Rambert especially for inviting me to give a talk here. And thank you all for coming. Last year I was giving a talk on the 12 Kalis. Also, I think 3 people came only. So this is the number of people who are interested in this stuff, it seems. Anyway, thank you for devoting your time. So I will be talking about the text, the Sanskrit text that is dated to 12th and or 13th century, called Mahatmanjari, that was written by Maheshwarananda. And this text exposes the doctrine and the practices of the so-called Kashmir Shaivism. And we know that Kashmir Shaivism is an umbrella term, which refers to the different schools of the non-dual Shaiva tradition, such as Pratibhigna, Krama, Kaula, Spanda, and Kula. And all these schools originated in Kashmir in early medieval period. So what is unique about this book, Mahatmanjari, is that although it exposes the doctrine and practices of the so-called Kashmir Shaivism, it was written in Chidambaram. And this is Chidambaram. And Chidambaram, as we all know, rose into prominence in the region between 9th to 13th century during the rule of the Chola kings. And it became a sacred dynastic center. It combined dynastic political authority with the prestige it derived from the presence of a major temple. And therefore it played a critical role in the South Indian Shaiva tradition as the center for the worship of the king of dances, Nataraja. So this is the famous icon that was actually invented by the Chola rulers. So these two distinct locations, we can say, Kashmir and Chidambaram, with their distinctive cultural and geographical heritages, became entangled in this work of Maheshwarananda, in his book called Mahatmanjari. So the importance of this composition, written in medieval Chidambaram, lies in the positioning of these two different cultural realms, one northern and the other southern, in a radically new arrangement, evoking interchangeability of their doctrinal elements. The famous Shiva, the king of dancers, Nataraja, becomes enshrined as a symbol of the Kashmiri Shaiva pantheon. In other words, he becomes entangled with a new conceptual paradigm in which doctrinal components drawn from this non-dual Shaiva tradition were creatively paralleled to give a new interpretative setting for comprehending dancing Shiva. So in this process, we may say that Nataraja acquires a new doctrinal identity that is formed by a novel theoretical and religious context. So, since my exposition is based on textual analysis, I will provide some passages from the Mahatmanjari, and then I will try to analyze them within this non-dual Shaiva context. So, first, let us turn first to the definition of the dancer provided by Maheshwarananda. He says thus: the dancer of this cosmic drama is Shambhu, the pure consciousness, and it is he who is the individual self, Purusha. For his indescribable state consists of assuming all the roles. So what we can say about this passage is that certainly Maheshwaranda's concept of the dancer has some kind of structural complexity entering into alternative formulations of the problem of agency of consciousness. This implicit complexity is also complicated by this metaphysical axiom of play that is presupposed in the dancer's ontology. Play offers a side to performative reality that watches constantly dancers' own transformation. So I would like to call it the play of bondage and liberation, or also the drama or the theater of bondage and liberation, which in a way can be understood as his self-given laws of acting dance or dance performance. In Maheshwaranda's understanding, play suggests the theatricalization of the reality in which the identity of the dancer is ascertained by his capability of assuming all the roles, including the Purusha. So the dancer is simultaneously the actor, displaying the cosmic drama that presupposes this capacity to enact or perform diversity. And here also, we know that in Indian tradition, it is very difficult to draw a clear distinction between the actor and the dancer. So even though I would be talking about also the dance performance, it also means that he's also the actor, not only the dancer, but also the actor. So Maishwanda begins his exposition, because this is the root verse, with the depiction of the dancer that constitutes the essential nature of both Shiva and Purusha. And if you want to say a few words about the theoretical framework that has influenced Maishwanda's concept, we may say that it developed on the basis of the two different theoretical standpoints. First, the non-dual Shaivism represented by the two schools, Pratabhijna and Krama. And another influence was the philosophical school of Sankhya. From a purely non-dual Shaiva point of view, Mahasvarananda drew this theory of a free agent who exists as a substratum for this constituent cognitive process of the five acts, and I will describe these five acts in a minute. So Mahasvarananda advocates the view that Shiva Purusha is a dancer because of his agency to constantly perform the five acts. And insofar as the philosophical school of Sankhya is concerned, Mahasvarananda's notion of Purusha the dancer and Prakriti the stage has been constructed in response to the already known Sankhya standpoint of the theater of the world, in which Prakriti displays the creation before the Purusha as the dancer before the audience. So one of the main objections that Mahasvarananda raised against the Sankhyakarika creed was passivity of Purusha and Prakriti's dependence on Purusha. In Mahasvarananda's view, Purusha is always omnipotent and omniscient, and Prakriti is interdependent of Purusha. So in this way, he actually contributes to a significant critique of Sankhya doctrine. So in my talk, I will try to analyze the figure of the dancer from five perspectives. First, I will try to answer the question, what does it mean to be a playful agent? Then I will throw some light on this metaphysical axiom of play, or the drama of bondage and liberation. Then I will turn to the exposition of the dance of Shiva, dance of Purusha, discovery of the autonomous agency of the five acts. Next, I will touch upon Mahasvarananda's critique of Sankhya doctrine. And at last, I will provide an example of a playful agent by examining the figure of Shiva magician and his deception of Maya. So first thing, what does it mean to be a playful agent? So this is a little bit philosophical, but I will also give some textual passages, maybe it will become easier to understand. The problem of agency is logically associated with an agent. To be an agent, it is necessary to be the self or the subject, and not an object that is acted upon. In non-dual Shaiva tradition, the problem of an agent and its agency is best formulated in the concept of the possessor of power, Shaktiman, and his power, Shakti. And Shaktiman is never bereft of Shakti. Their ontological interdependence is evoked in the expressions that, in the formulation that express mutual consent. So we say sweetness in sugar, heat in fire, whiteness in milk. So in this way, milk is a Shaktiman and whiteness is his Shakti. So that these expressions are very often used in non-dual Shaiva texts to refer to the agency and the agent. In non-dual Shaiva tradition, agency belongs to the agent who is endowed with the attributes of sovereignty, Aishwarya, and freedom, Swatantrya. While agent is free and sovereign, his agency is constituted by the powers of knowledge, Jnana Shakti, and Kriya Shakti. Agency and its agent are always reduced to will, Ichha. And from the Ishvara Pratabhijna Vimarshini, we have the quotation, will itself is the cause, the agent and the agency. Of particular significance to our explanation is that It is in fact the agency of knowledge and action that constitutes a defining feature of a playful agent, the dancer. Moreover, to say that the agent is the one who exercises the powers of knowledge and action is to accept the agency to whom sovereignty, to the agent to whom sovereignty is ascribed. And Abhinavagupta actually justifies the statement when he refers to the powers of knowledge and action as to constituting a defining feature of Lord's playfulness. And in the Ishvara Pratyabhijna Dvimarshini that is quoted by Mahasivananda, he explained that he describes it as: the being of Great Lord consists in his eternal self-consciousness, unrestrained freedom, perfect independence of others, and in being essentially pure bliss. This very freedom, which is identical with self-consciousness, constitutes the pure and ultimately real powers of knowledge and action of the playful Lord. The power of knowledge is essentially the light of consciousness, and the power of action is nothing but reflective awareness, which is essentially freedom, and which has its being in the light of consciousness. And freedom is the essence of the light of consciousness. The powers of knowledge and action, therefore, at the transcendental level, are nothing more than a free will. Here, the playfulness of Shiva is dependent on his sovereignty and freedom to exercise the powers of knowledge and action. And Mahasivananda advocates a very similar argument when he explains thus: this is the sovereignty of Paramashiva, the Great Lord, who animates the entire universal play reflected in knowledge and action, interiority and externality. Therefore, he is named in different agamas as freedom, vibration, vibrating radiance. In this explanation, the universal playfulness points towards Shiva's agency, characterized as the cosmological power that unfolds multiplicity within the fundamental unity with the divine. The universal playfulness indicates a synthetic structure that includes rather than excludes bipolar reality, inner and outer, cognition and action, etc. Synthesis of the opposites provides common foundation both for unity and difference or change. This is best exemplified in another passage of Mahatma Manjari, dealing with the problem of world's diversity, which, although based in division, is not conditioned by actual distinction. So the text says, again, quotation from Mahatma Manjari: the various categories of existence, though distinct from one another in their outer form, must be, in terms of their essential specific nature, a single collective reality. It is this, in fact, what we call non-differentiation, abheda. Therefore, there is nothing inconclusive in saying that this non-differentiation is the actual true nature of the universal playfulness. The same powers of knowledge and action, evidentially realizable in play, are responsible for calling Shiva God, Deva. Interestingly, for Abhinavagupta, the very act of play makes Shiva to be God. Following the traditional semantic analysis, Nirvachana, Abhinavagupta traces the etymology of the word Deva, God, to the verbal root div, meaning play, sport, fun. And he says diviati means kridati iti devaha. Here again, play-centered ontology of God is defined in terms of agency to exercise the powers of knowledge and action. In the Tantra Loka, he says, Deva also indicates that being who is everywhere, as he is qualified by knowledge and action, and who is thus omniscient and omnipotent. This is his movement. In the commentary of this on this verse, Jayaratha explains, his movement, even in the midst of all goal-oriented activity, is of the nature of enlightened consciousness, consisting of the universal dancer, whose quality is knowledge and action. In discussing Abhinavagupta's thought, it is crucial to emphasize that the powers of knowledge and action, identifying, in a way, God's playfulness, are always necessarily connected with the movement of the universal dancer. This implies that the playful agent is in motion. His kinetic energy unfolds in the movement of knowledge and action. The powers of knowledge and action, so jnana and kriya, shaktis, are inseparable, because action is nothing but free consciousness manifesting itself both externally and internally in accordance with temporal order, and as such it belongs to the subject. For the non-dual Shaivites, only consciousness can assume the position of the agent, karta, because only consciousness is capable of assuming different forms without affecting his essential oneness, and in this way it is capable of affecting the power of action. Moreover, the capacity of exercising the power of action and the act of assuming different forms is possible under one necessary condition, that is freedom, whose essential nature is a will or a desire to do. In non-dual Shaiva tradition, nothing happens unintentionally. Intentionality, it is called apeksha, is a necessary prerequisite on the part of the agent for the action to take place. So far, the notion of agency has been that I have explained has been exhibited within the single intentional will, act of the will of the agent. But there is also a soteriological level. So the notion of agency combining with itself the powers of knowledge and action represents a typical non-dual Shaiva pursuit of the path of power. As Alexis Anderson pointed out, the non-dual Shaivites follow the path of power, which is effectively contrasted with the orthodox Brahmanical path of purity. The path of power is based on the recognition of a state of self-imposed bondage arising from ignorance forged by impurity with regards to one's own essential nature, or, more precisely, with regards to an unawareness of an innate powers of knowledge and action constituting a characteristic feature of the playful agent. In contrast with the dualistic Shaiva Siddhanta notion of the impurity regarded as a material substance, non-dual Shaivas consider impurity to be abiding in thought only. Therefore, impurity associated with the free malas, free stance, is effective in generating the wrong perception of one's own true self. And two of these things, anavamana and karmamana, are understood respectively as an incomplete realization of one's own omniscient power of knowledge as an incomplete realization of one's own omnipotent power of action. So the path of power is actually, to summarize, the path of power is this realization of one's own innate agency in which ordinary contracted and impure consciousness is transformed into omnipotence and omniscience. Mahasivananda seems to follow this line of reasoning when he introduces an image of the dancer to represent the fullest realization of the inherent agency, consisted of the powers of knowledge and action, and constituting the nature of Shiva, the playful agent. I think I have one quotation where he describes this. The Supreme Lord experiences the cognition which comprises of knowledge of his own nature's essential freedom, which is pure, namely devoid of limitation, impurity and doubt, as it is followed by the great ascetic wonder of all-pervading experience of his universal nature being the world, as expressed by the statement, I am indeed all. It is the only reason why he is thought to be a performer, the dancer of this world drama, as it is said in the Shiva Sutra, the self is the dancer. So now let me say a few things about this play of bondage and liberation, or the drama of bondage and liberation. The play or drama of bondage and liberation is a central theme in Mahasivananda's exposition of the dancer, through which he attempts to approach a metaphysical problem of the absolute autonomy within the non-dual Shaiva framework. What characterizes the dancer is clearly a play which he enacts as a sign of his total freedom. This is the play of bondage and liberation. If bondage and liberation are both taken to signify the highest degree of freedom, non-duality of the absolute being is affirmed. The same thought has led Mahasivananda to the adaptation of the concept of play, known as Krida Vilasa Rukhela, that aimed at demonstrating the pleasure of self-veiling, which is bondage, and revelation, which is liberation, as the self-given laws of active dance. In this context, Mahasivananda seems to follow Abhidhamma Gupta, who elucidates on this topic in the following verses of his Paramarthasara, which is quoted by Mahasivananda. And as he veils and reveals his own self, the Supreme Shiva displays his wonderful play, Krida, his sporting hela of servitude and deliverance. Shiva's play appears here as this frivolous faculty to perform the drama of self-veiling and revelation. The same ideas expressed in the Sara Shastra quoted by Mahasivananda. The Sovereign of God himself binds and liberates. He himself is the subject who experiences enjoyment and pain, and he himself cognizes. So does he examine himself. The play of bondage and liberation is related to two cosmological acts of Shiva, concealment, Tirodhana, and grace, Anugraha, that seem to operate at the intersection of the eternal dichotomies. Bondage is a necessary criterion for the availability of grace. But Shiva's play of bondage and liberation also signals the enactment of the universal performance. Shiva the dancer represents a main character in this play, acting out multiple roles. The specific feature of Shiva the dancer, defined as his indescribable state, is his ability to assume all the roles. A basic principle of this performative competency is his ability to assume all the roles. A basic principle of this performative competency is its universality, that reflects the view that Shiva is equally present in all conditions and all states, whether pleasant or unpleasant. Yet another trait accentuated in this discussion is his intrinsic attitude of a frolicsome mood. Shiva is credited with playfulness when he engages himself in role-playing. His ability to play out multiple roles is a sign of his reflective self. This topic is actually repeated constantly in non-dual Shaiva scriptures, but two examples of this kind that are quoted by Mahashivananda are taken from the Shiva Drishti. So the first quotation, just as a king ruling over the whole earth in the joyful intoxication of supremacy can act out as being a simple soldier imitating his behavior, so in his supreme happiness the Lord amuses himself by assuming the manifold forms of the totality. And then the next quotation from Shiva Drishti, quoted by Mahashivananda. Due to his playfulness, the Lord assumes different forms of the bodies that reside in the darkness on the infernal ocean. These are the vessels for suffering, agents that yet to have paid the bill of their deeds. So even some evil forms, even evil bodies that reside in the darkness of the infernal ocean, he is actually the Lord Shiva himself playing this hide and seek. The necessity of examining the reasons behind Shiva play in bondage and liberation led non-dual Shaivites to the ascertainment of Shiva's total freedom, characterized by his ability to do the impossible. Mahashivananda says that the Lord is skilled in the play of veiling his own self because of his freedom and his play. He can do this what is extremely difficult. Here again, Mahashivananda seems to follow Abhinavagupta, who compares Shiva's capacity of self-veiling in the individual souls, in Purushas, with his activity of dancing. He refers to this theme in the following words, again quotation from the Tantra Loka. O you, togetherness of beings, you who forcefully laying hold of the hearts of men, with your many modes of acting dance, you, concealing your own heart, play. For Mahashivananda, these stanzas of the Tantra Loka prove that Shiva, as a part of his inexplicable play, descends on the path of Maya to assume the role of the individual self, Purusha. His argument that assigns to the dancer a constitutive essential nature of both Shiva and Purusha comes in two steps. The first step is intended out to rule out the idea that Purusha is different from Shiva. Second, Purusha and Shiva are identical because of their ability to perform the five acts. The second step in Mahashivananda's argument points out towards Purusha's powerlessness to recognize Shiva's self as the agent of his actions. This powerlessness occurs due to a false association with the psychophysical organism, governed by a sense of egoity, as expressed in the statement. This is a quotation from the Virupaksha Panchashika. I am healthy, I am thin, I love, I enjoy, I respire, I am void. In these six stages, egoity is seen. The powerlessness can be converted into the omnipotence under one condition. What is essential is precisely the recognition that it is the agent, the self, that stands behind the various operations of the psychophysical organism. Mahashivananda supports this idea in the following paragraph. The body and the senses must have the agent driving them, and this agent is certainly the self. What other justification is approved with regards to the agent of all the variety of worldly phenomena? So discovery of one's own self as being the agent of all actions is above all a discovery of this autonomous agency to perform the five acts, the Panchakritya. And now I will turn to the exposition of this agency, the dance of Shiva, dance of Purusha, discovery of the autonomous agency of the five acts. Bhavashvarananda tends to focus on showing that identification between Shiva and Purusha becomes established on the ground of sharing a uniform nature of the dancer. The dancer is the one who dances, and his dance is identified with this autonomous agency to perform the five acts, the Panchakritya of creation, Srishti, maintenance, Sthiti, withdrawal, Samhara, concealment, Tirodhana, and grace Anugraha. Panchakritya of Shiva is one of the basic precepts of Shaiva tradition, whether Shaiva Siddhanta or non-dual Shaivites. Shiva incessantly performs his five acts in the transcendent and immanent realm. These five acts are always linked to his playful spontaneity. The dancer is never bereft of his agency to perform the five acts. In this sense, dancing is a paradigm of dynamic ontology. Even now, if you go to the Chidambaram Nataraja temple and ask what really is Shiva's dance, the priest will tell you that it is his Panchakritya. While discussing the problem of agency, Mahashwanda offers unprecedented analysis of dance movement performed by Shiva, basing his descriptions in the five acts, unfolding in two different spheres of manifestation, macrocosmic and microcosmic. In other words, dance has the outer and inner dimension. The outer, macrocosmic form of acting dance is exemplified in this cosmological display of 36 categories of existence, tattvas, ranging from Shiva up to Earth. Quoting from Rishi Nayaswasan, Mahashwarananda says, "You, by your own innermost self, are the dancer, the protector of this globe." No, this is not the quotation. Oh, sorry. This is the quotation from Srinai Swasa, but there is some mistake. So the quotation is as follows. "You, by your own innermost self, are the dancer, the protector of this globe." Here the idea of Shiva's agency is grounded in this general concept of the cosmological process consisting of the five acts, creation, maintenance. So when he maintains, he protects the globe. But there is also inner, macrocosmic form of acting dance that takes place in the individual self, in Purusha. So Shiva dances the Purusha insofar as he performs the five acts in the drama of human life. So this is another quotation from Srinayaswasa. "Through enacting the drama of being a person, through each and every one of the dramatic junctures, birth, childhood, youth, maturity and death, at the final curtain, I am Shiva, the best of dancers." Birth, childhood, youth, maturity, death. These are the five moments of time imitating the play of the dancer. Therefore, there is a specific temporality that belongs equally to the experience of life and experience of play, the temporality of playing a part in the cosmic drama. However fleeting and transient is the nature of the stages, there is no bridge in the absolute non-dualism in which Shiva, the great dancer, acts out all and at all times. With intention to prove the ontological uniformity between Shiva and Purusha, Mahashwarananda argued that possession of the autonomous agency of the five acts belongs equally to both. On the level of the Purusha, the five acts constituting Shiva's cosmological process assume a form of the fivefold cognitive process. So this cosmological agency of Shiva, the Panchakritya, becomes transferred, in a way, into an agency of a purely cognitive type. And he characterizes this agency in terms of the krama, fivefold cognitive act, known as Panchavaha. So there is Panchakritya becomes Panchavaha. So his argument has two stages. In the first, he argues that Purusha is actually being consubstantial with Shiva, but he remains ignorant about his real status, due to deficiency of the descent of power, Shaktipata. To use his example, even the potter possesses the state of being of the all-powerful Shiva while making a pot, but failing to realize it, he remains only a potter. This example echoes Pratyabhijna's notion of the omnipotent agent, in which a potter erroneously identifies himself to be the agent of his actions. What he should realize is that it is the Lord himself who is the agent of his actions, therefore the potter is not a limited, but the universal creator. In the second, he sharpens his argument by saying that even while existing in the domain of Maya, Purusha possesses the autonomous agency of consciousness identified with the five arts. And this is a very long quotation. So he elaborates on this topic in the following words. Therefore, freedom of consciousness constitutes the essence of Purusha. So in the actual process of perceiving something, for example, a pillar, where there is a kind of expectancy towards perceiving the pillar, that is called creation, srishti. Having said thus, creation takes place through Purusha alone, insofar as it is perceived to be something different from the other, like a jar. Once this vision has been established for two or three moments, that is called permanence, titi, since permanence is a tag given to the continuity of the specific forms held by the material objects. When the attention shifts to the other object, a jar, then the pillar is dissolved, and the jar is created. But when there is an intermediate state in between abandonment of the pillar and the creation of the jar, this state is called the fourth, Turiya, where, in the absence of the cognizable objects, only pure consciousness remains. As it is said in Sri Komalavali Stotra, the intermediary state suspended between the object left and that one which hasn't yet attained there, O Mother, is that which yogis consider to be your non-dual reality. Threaded through this fourfold sequence and yet able to transcend it, is the power of consciousness that exists within the self called luminosity, bhasa. Or better still, during the act of mental unification, anusandhana, of something like a pillar, when the attention is fixed upon its being a pillar, then the fact of its being made of wood is suppressed. On the other hand, when the attention fixes on its being made of wood, then the fact of its being a pillar is suppressed. Therefore, if there is a creation of something, then there is a destruction of the other. That is clearly noticed. But when properties of being a pillar and being made of wood are recognized at once, there is a permanence, titi, as both cognitions are present. And when there is a dissolution of the thought constructs of being a pillar, then there is the state called the inexplicable, anakya. When there is a reflection for the radiance of the self, there is luminosity, bhasa. Thus, the different kinds of creation, permanence, dissolution, the inexplicable, and luminosity are to be seen there. Similarly, when the Purusha beholds a pillar in correlation with time, space, and form, he is not merely the would-be creator of its delimited manifestation, nor he is merely the would-be retractor of its delimited manifestation, when it is not delimited by space, time, etc. And the Purusha is not merely the would-be sustainer of universal properties, for example, pillarness. The Purusha does experience the fourth state when he perceives without thought constructs, and also he bestows grace when revealing phenomena to be identical with the light of consciousness. In this regard, Purusha is establishing the sovereignty that is simultaneously... That is simultaneously performing the five acts. The reflection on the five acts aims at the realization of this autonomous universal agency that belongs to the universal self, Purusha. The ultimate identity of Shiva and Purusha can be discovered in the realm of the cognitive process. The macrocosmic set of the five cosmological acts has its equivalent in the inner microcosmic dimension of the cognitive process. This is, according to Mahasvarnada, a liberating dance of consciousness based in the sovereignty of the individual self. By attending to the inherent fivefold dynamism of the cognitive process that emerges and subsides in the course of perception, and seeing it as a universal process, the agent realizes his autonomous agency and his Shivahood. So now I will touch upon Mahasvarnada's critique of Sankhya's theatric universe. As we all know, this metaphysical scheme of Sankhya is constituted by this Dhyatattvas, Purusha and Prakriti, whose relation is effective in creating the world of phenomenal existence, and the most common distinction between these two lies in considering Purusha as consciousness and Prakriti as matter or nature. And the whole phenomenal world that is embodied in 33 tattvas is in some way derived from the combination of these two grounding principles. And the relationship between Purusha and Prakriti in Sankhya is poetically illustrated by the image of the feminine Prakriti, displaying the creation before of the phenomenal world before the Purusha, who is this inactive witness, just like the dancer before the audience. According to the Sankhyakarika creed, the tender and bashful Prakriti performs her dance for Purusha, the inactive witness. Purusha is the seat of pure consciousness without content, the inactive spectator, possessed of isolation or freedom from experience, and therefore he is not given any meaning in the theory of causation. Because it is only Prakriti who is the real cause of real effects, and from Egypt the 23 tattvas called evolutions or transformations takes form. So Purusha's role in the cosmological process is that of the inactive spectator, casting some kind of mystical shadow, and having been in some mysterious way stimulized by Purusha's mute presence, Prakriti begins to dance his her world performance, and her world performance displays the psychophysical organism of macrocosmic and microcosmic kind. That is, that consists of different modes of awareness, emotions, sensations, physicality, the senses, and so on. So just to give you a brief overview of the Sankhya concept, Mahesh-Fernanda actually took over Sankhya's idea of the theatric universe with an intention of a polemic reformulation of this concept. So his notion of Purusha the dancer and Prakriti the stage is the amended version of the Sankhya standpoint of the Purusha the spectator and Prakriti the dancer. And this illustrative portrayal is enough to notice the relation of attainment and detachment operating in both instances, and hence also the differences between Sankhya and non-dual Shaivism. In the first case, Purusha and Prakriti, in the first case means in the Sankhya case, Purusha and Prakriti exist in a in the first instance means in the non-dual Shaiva instance, Purusha and Prakriti exist in a close relationship, in so much as the stage by on which by means of which individual soul comes into Purusha is the Prakriti is the stage in by means of which Purusha comes into contact with this rich nature of objective manifestation. And in the second case, in Sankhya case, Purusha and Prakriti exist in an abstract isolation from one another. So Prakriti is acting at some distance away from Purusha, and this distance separates them. So Mahesh-Fernanda begins with a critique of Sankhya account that aspires to make Purusha the inactive agent. And he tends to establish the incomprehensibility of Sankhya conclusion by showing internal contradictions in the opponent's position. So he tries actually to reject the Sankhya view on the following basis. So he says he puts the objection to the Sankhya's position. How is it that an entity said to be totally passive can have any effect on the world? How can one even infer its existence? The opponent's response, so the Sankhya response: the conscious and passive entity sets primal matter in motion, as there is no other way that creation could begin. It is for this reason that one both accepts the conscious entity's existence and sets about proving it. And now Mahesh-Fernanda rebuttal. The passive involvement of the entity cannot then be accepted, because it sets in motion other actions. It must itself be active, even if only slightly. Even admitting this slight degree of action, however, falsifies the opponent's contention. So he says that Purusha cannot be inactive, if there must be even a slight degree of action, because he is in some way responsible for Prakriti's creation. So in this way, Mahesh-Fernanda criticizes Sankhya's concept of the unmover, who in some mysterious way impels Prakriti to act by proving logical impossibility of any action to be instigated by the inactive Purusha. Even the subtle action requires the active agent. So we can see that these two positions have completely different concept of Prakriti and Purusha. So non-dual Shaivism is in fact rejects this concept of the silent spectator. For non-dual Shaivites, there is only spontaneous agent, and the goal of the whole process is to experience himself in the variety of the all manifestations. So the last part of this presentation is an example of a playful agent, and I will talk about Shiva magician and his deception of Maya. The concept of a magician god creating the world through the act of magic can be traced back to the Rig Veda, where Indra, by a touch of his magician wand, lightning, and by his magic spell, the thunder, conjures up the cosmic illusion to deceive people and gods. And this illusory trick is known as Indra's net, Indrajala. Quotation from the Atharva Veda. Indra's net is vast, as big as this world, and with Indra's net, this magic, I enmesh and trap those people with darkness. Another example of world magic is given in the Shvetashvatara Upanishad, where nature is an illusion and the Lord is the illusionist. The things of this world are but elements of him. Similarly, in the Bhagavad Gita, God announces that he comes into being through magic. The world is my divine magic, hard to figure out. Commenting on the verse, Ramanuja explains that God is appropriated as a magician, Mayavin, tricking the world, staging a cosmic version of the street magic performance, during which the magician, by his devices, creates not a reality, but an idea or illusion of a reality, a meaningless image that is thought to have meaning, significance, palpability. This early notion of the magical illusion had been developed further in the philosophical concept of Maya, implying this mysterious, bewildering power of creation. Etymologically, the word Maya is derived from the Sanskrit root ma, to measure out, to show, but it came to denote the phenomenal world emanating from the absolute Brahman or Shiva. So, Gonda has a nice quotation about Maya. Maya is an incomprehensible wisdom and power, enabling its possessor or being able itself to create, devise, contrive, affect, or do something. So we see this example calls our attention to this creative power of Maya. But it should be noted that this creative power is set in motion to fabricate, to conceal, to disguise the truth lurking behind the masquerade. So the another characteristic feature of Maya is that it binds humans in the world of transmigration by projecting illusory world, the magical craft of appearances. And as we all know, in the field of Indian philosophy, Maya became this important epistemological and metaphysical concept in the Advaita Vedanta, promulgated by Gaudapada and Shankara. So just to give a few basic things about that. In Advaita Vedanta, the epistemological status of Maya predicates erroneous perception that deludes self-consciousness of the individual Atman. And in explaining the power of Maya, the Advaitin turns into the famous analogy of a magician and a trick. When a magician makes a trick of a snake in a rope, we are deluded by it, we take the illusion for reality, but a magician is not tricked by his act of magic. So he remains unaffected. Similarly, Brahman conjures up a magic show of the empirical world that vanishes with the boon of knowledge. And metaphysically, Maya is enigmatic power of Brahman that fools us into believing that the empirical world is real when it is not. Epistemologically, Maya is in science, avidya. It has the power of concealing reality, avarna shakti, and also of distorting reality, vikshapa shakti, that makes a rope to be mistakenly perceived as a snake. According to the Advaita Vedanta system, Brahman alone is real, unchanging and true. Everything else, including empirical world, is just an illusion and untrue. And to disentangle this interlaced course of the illusory net of Maya is to go behind appearances, to unveil the curtain of science, to understand that the fiction lays no claim of being true. And once it is accomplished, this Maya disappears, and then automatically the reality of Brahman stands revealed. Non-dual Shaivas agree With Advaita Vedanta's notion of Maya as comprising of itself the powers of concealment, avarana, delusion, moha, and obscuration, tirodhana. Still, a distinction between these two systems is perhaps best seen as advocating different idea regarding the relation between Maya and Absolute. In accordance with Advaita Vedanta's fundamental premise, Maya is effectively contrasted with Brahman, which alone is real and true, right? Whereas from the Shaiva point of view, Maya is Shiva's supreme power of freedom, Swatantra Shakti, generating the most wonderful spectacle of phenomenal existence. For Mahishvananda, Maya is alone the proof for Shiva's freedom. So he writes this. This is a quotation from the Mahatmanjali. Maya is alone the highest level of his Shiva's autonomy. The fact that he has ability to produce the great variety of differences and subdivisions, even though the world, as it actually exists, is not different from the manifestation of his self. It is because of this the Lord is declared to be the one who can accomplish the most difficult of tasks. And for the same reason, he is the Lord of the world, the master of the variety of phenomena, such as bodies, sense organs, worlds. Without Maya, the variety of phenomena, which is really the extension of difference, would cease to exist. And were it to cease to exist, the power of the Lord would make sense, and thus absolutely nothing could become manifest. Thus, this thing called Maya is the highest form of God's autonomy. Aforementioned passage equates Maya with the essential agency of Shiva, where the agent is the creator endowed with the capacity for deliberative creative action. One important concern Mahishvananda brings out here is that this agency involves what is called freedom to perform the most difficult of tasks. However, Maya is not only Shiva's power of freedom, Swatantra Shakti. In an attempt to develop an adequate understanding of Maya, yet another concept has to be taken into consideration. In this regard, Maya is also the power of delusion, Mohani Shakti. I don't know whether I have this quotation here or no. The capacity to confound even the liberated man with the fear of bondage and confound even the bound man with the mistaken notion of liberation is the power of Maya. So these two aspects of Maya, freedom and delusion, are not to be considered in isolation from one another, for they exist in a process of constant interplay, emphasizing perhaps the most important feature of Shiva's agency, its playfulness. His playfulness. Maya is the Lord's own disguise through which he expresses his total freedom. Maya is also his capacity to experience his freedom in the wonderful variety of manifestation. He plays out of the joyful and vibrating delight of his own nature, experiencing astonishing diversity in his being. There seems to be no other reasons for the existence of Maya than play. Moreover, the playful disposition of Shiva seems to assign to his unique nature a double role, one superior and transcendent, and another inferior, present in the realm of Maya and individual self, Purusha. Mahishvananda points out that Shiva's ability to assume a double role of Shiva and Purusha is executed by a figure of a magician. Shiva is called the magician, Ainrajalika, though he tricks the entire world by assuming a role of the individual self, Purusha, the subject of Maya. He is not tricked by anything. There is the same deceiving pattern discernible within the realm of cognitive process. Shiva is called the deceiver or a cheater, Dhurta, for he disguises himself assuming a triple nature of cognizer, cognition and cognizable object. All these various illusionistic tricks performed by Shiva have a single purpose, that is freedom. Ultimately, everything is the manifestation of pure consciousness, the mere sport of Shiva's own conscious nature. As a result, nothing is unreal, because both real and unreal belong to the content of Shiva consciousness that pervades all. On this assumption, Shiva's capacity to disguise himself under the veil of Maya and fool others is the outcome of his playful nature. To understand the Maya as the play of Shiva is to become fully engaged in the game of hide and seek, and this is the path of liberation. So, just to summarize, I want to say that Advaita Vedanta and non-dual Shaivism, represented by Mahishvananda, advocates two distinctive approaches to the understanding of Maya. What is the difference? In Advaita Vedanta, understanding of Maya is based on this exclusive or absolute separation of the unreal and real. As a consequence, unreal Maya, the source of falsity, exists in the diametrical opposition to the real Brahman. On the other hand, in non-dual Shaivism, there is this positive attitude towards empirical world of Maya. Everything is real, even unreal is real. And therefore, we can say they promote this concept of freedom, that is freedom to experience, to know, to act. And all of this belongs actually to Shiva's playful agency. Shiva, the playful agent who actively participates in the world of Maya, in this wonderful dance of appearances. So that's all what I wanted to share with you today. Thanks.